I am Angus Keble, and welcome to Factum Agri, dedicated to New Zealand's agriculture industry. Key areas of focus are industry analysis with key stakeholders, policy makers, engagement with farmers and producers, and working to close the rural-urban divide. Farmers work hard, they love the land, and are a critical part of New Zealand's fabric. There are many things for farmers to think about, whether it be drought, market conditions and farm gate returns, and the increased pressure from the public or policy makers. Working with Postquake Farming, we are taking a look at what farmers are doing to improve their businesses, their biodiversity, their land use and their well-being. The environment has a significant impact on farming and rural communities. And as our environment changes, farmers are increasingly at risk of the impacts that this change brings. Often something that is overlooked is the impact an earthquake can have on rural communities. This of course adds to already trying conditions that many face. At midnight on 14 November 2016, a magnitude 8 earthquake struck in the Kaikoura region. Ruptures occurred on multiple faults from the North Canterbury High Country through to Kikarangu, north of Kaikoura. That earthquake has been described as the most complex earthquake ever studied. It caused substantial and wide-ranging land damage across large areas of the North Canterbury Hill and High Country. Immediately, obvious impacts included damage to farmhouses and buildings, fences, water systems and access tracks. Stresses on people and livestock were very evident, both in relation to the immediate impact of the event and the sudden unexpected loss of stock water infrastructure and the loss of road access for some months after. The Papatea Fault, one of 24 in the region that ruptured along a system of right lateral strike slip faults in the Kaikoura region. These faults transfer slip from the right lateral alpine fault. Due to the Kaikoura earthquake, there is evidence that the Wairarapa fault line to the north has increased pressure and is at risk of rupturing. The Wairarapa fault line is responsible for New Zealand's most severe earthquake since colonisation. In 1855, an 8.2 magnitude earthquake caused severe damage across the region and generated a tsunami. So, it is important and relevant for all farming communities throughout New Zealand to learn from events caused by the Kaikoura earthquake. This week on Factum Agri, we move north to the Wairarapa to discuss climate change and the impact this is having on farmer William Beetham's business. And I'm lucky enough to have NIWA scientist Petra Pierce join me once again. Firstly, let's check in with William. Hello, William. Thank you for talking with me today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Please, can you tell me about your farm, where you are located and what you farm?
Yeah, okay. So I'm actually sixth generation farming the beautiful Wanneroo Valley, just east of Masterton. So our family first settled there 1856. We're sheep and beef farmers. We've got 1,200 hectares effective, but the entire properties are about 1,500, just over 1,500 hectares. So got a lot of combination of native bush and forestry and other bits and pieces within our business, within our farming life. And yeah, so we're just quarter of an hour east of Masterton, pretty much summer dry country, and finishing lambs and also breeding lambs and also finishing cattle.
Do you finish all your own progeny?
Yeah, we do. So we finish about just over 7,500 lambs we breed ourselves. And then we also will buy in, depending on the season, we also trade and buy other lambs and do an autumn, early winter trade. So, yeah, we finished quite a few lambs.
Today we're talking about climatic changes on farm. Have you noticed any changes to rainfall or temperature on your property over the last 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. So, I mean, I've been farming for 12 years and I have certainly seen quite a lot of climate variability in that time of 12 years. But the variability that we've sort of seen, we've actually been able to go back through old family records right back to the late 1800s. And we find some interesting diary notes around our Wairarapa River that goes through our property, through the middle of our property. I've had it once in my lifetime, which was a couple of years ago, that was actually dry through winter. It was the worst drought that we'd experienced. We went on for 2 years. And we've actually seen other diary entries from the late 1800s, where the river was dry at the same time as well, too. So I think we certainly know from our experience that there's always been that climate variability. But one of the things that we're really noticing is that over the last few years, or consistently over time, our winters are sort of starting to get much more pleasurable, let's say, warmer. And we are certainly seeing more variability in rainfall and less average rainfall. It's been interesting, you know, it hasn't meant that we've grown less grass, that we've had less average, less rainfall. So that's going from 900, you know, we used to have up to a metre annual rainfall. Now we're sort of seeing about 800 over the last few years, 800 to 850. But that rainfall is still falling. It's falling over a bigger spread. So, yeah, it's just looking at our data. And I mean, it's only anecdotal, but it seems like we are seeing some changes, which we find interesting. But it hasn't meant that we've grown less dry matter in a year at this stage.
And just on that, have you had to make any changes to your farming system over the years to accommodate these changes? An example might be a reduction or increase in stocking rates or the type of feed you grow?
Yeah, we're constantly making changes to adapt and for lots of reasons, not only to adapt to our changing environment, but also to adapt to I suppose whether if it's regulatory or market driven opportunities. And so we've brought in things like adding lamb trading and decreasing capital stock numbers over winter to enable us to be more resilient. We use a lot of forage crops to ensure that we can finish our lambs through early summer, so we're not caught in those, which is our typical really risk period, which is March, April. We have systems to supplementary feed all of our cattle, our capital stock, which is mostly ewes, and that's based around supplementary feeding, in late summer to try and protect our lambing percentage. So, and now we're moving into looking at combining plants. So we're using kale and plantain now to look at using that as a platform to manage ewes both in late summer to ensure we can protect their live weight and effectively make sure we scan. So yeah, we've made quite a few changes and are consistently looking at how we can do it better to manage our environmental risk.
Has your typical trading periods changed at all over the years?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we used to basically still finish all our own lambs, but they would go right through to finishing off a lot of those lambs in July, August even. Now we're really focused on making sure that we can, you know, finish our own lambs by the end of summer as much as we can, and then we can take advantage of trading in that autumn, early winter period. But we've also really focused on making sure that all of our trading stock have to be off the property by July. So basically what we're trying to do is farm the shoulders of the seasons and when we actually can be guaranteed in growing grass. One of the other things about it is that we don't, we have the option not to do the trade in autumn should we have had a very risky autumn period. We will then buy a lot of cattle in September, October, that will consume a lot of our extra spring feed. So that gives us a real opportunity. We find that we always get the security of the spring feed, and that generally has come even in the worst years, but the autumn is the biggest risk. So we build our trading system around that.
What is your view on increased water storage for the purpose of irrigation?
Well, I think that if we look at increased water storage based around irrigation, we're being very blinkered. We're creating a very tunnel visioned around water storage. Any water storage actually creates great opportunities for the entire community or for individual landowners. So if one outcome might be that there is an opportunity to irrigate, it could be an opportunity to create increased water reticulation for stock, which gives us great opportunities to be more resilient through harsh droughts and summer dry periods. It creates an opportunity to slow down the water, which it was traditionally happened anyway, pre-human, and create things like create great biodiversity outcomes in terms of wetlands and other areas. And then if we're looking at more broader projects, you know, currently in the Wairarapa, there is real challenges around supplying water to our urban communities, making sure we can maintain river flows, and also making sure that we can deliver water to our industry that employs a large proportion of of people in our urban communities in the Wairarapa. So water storage for us on a larger scale, and there's many different types of water storage, we're not just talking about dams, is going to be critical to our resilience in the future, not just for irrigation as a piece of the puzzle, but security of water for our communities and our industry is absolutely critical, along with irrigation.
Do you think there's a disconnect between urban and rural communities?
I wouldn't say. I don't think there's a disconnect. I think there is a change. There's been a change in the way that rural communities, I think, have been viewed, and that's been built around media and around communications and probably slight lack of understanding. But if you actually strip all of that away, we still are New Zealanders, and you know, and we all hold the same values, and it's why we live here. It's why we're a part of our own society, and we're so lucky to be New Zealanders and live such amazing country. And I think that when we start to ignore those values, then we start to get, I suppose, this discontent or the lack of understanding. Whereas if we actually just embrace the fact that we're all New Zealanders, we all actually have the same values around, you know, strong community, a fair society, you know, trying to do our best for our environment, to get the best outcomes for our communities, and really deliver for future generations, then we're all actually the same and we're all trying to do the same. It's just then we can start to build understanding, which is one of the biggest things I think is missing, is that a lot of urban communities just don't, urban people don't have that same time on farm, perhaps they used to, and so they don't quite understand what we do. And the more we can we can break down that that small piece of understanding, the more we can reconnect to our own core values again.
What is your view on the national policy statement for freshwater management?
Oh, listen, freshwater, the national policy statement, well, the NPS and the National Environment Standard and the changes to the RMA that have just come out have all been part of a process that's been going on for a long time, looking at how we can put a regulatory framework around better managing our freshwater resource in New Zealand. And that journey has had many ups and downs and has created many great outcomes, but also probably many negative outcomes. And I think that the current, the most recent changes that have been made and the reforms that have been released have some benefit. The problem is, I think that the process hasn't been as robust as it could have been. And maybe it would be fantastic if those in government, and as I said, this has gone through both the national government and a Labor-led government, if we just continue to focus on getting really good process. Because when we get a really good process and everybody's involved and we can talk about the opportunities and the implications, we can get really good outcomes. And I'm just not sure that this is I'm not sure that that has happened at this point in time with the current regulations. And I think we're seeing that in the fact that they've just been released and already they're being reviewed. So I think if we could come back to just to making sure we've got really good process and working together, we're going to get the right outcomes, which is just everybody has the same values and wants to achieve the same thing.
Is farming becoming harder, William? Not you specifically, but in a general sense?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you look, I mean, we could just look at the history of our family and our family farming. And, you know, you went through periods where it's been, I suppose, really buoyant and let's say easier. And then we've had other times that it's been hard. But if you look at this current situation we're in, we're dealing with very, I suppose, mature markets. We're not dealing with a simple market whereby we basically processed our product and sent it overseas and that was great. Now we're really in a place where we've got to understand our consumer, we've got to understand their needs, we've got to understand their values, we've got to capture as much value as we possibly can and really ensure that we're right at the top of the value chain. Now we're distributing, you know, it's not effectively sending one product overseas. You know, our lambs, for example, they end up in, you know, a multitude, 60, 70 different products that all add value back to us as a farmer. And so we've got to make sure that we're working with our processor marketers and other parts of the value chain to ensure that we're extracting the most value out of each part of that. And then at the same time, we've got to make sure we continue to manage our social license as farmers whilst and we're thinking about what it looks like from the outside in, and the simplistic things that we see day to day, how is that viewed, and how do we communicate why that's a normal thing as a part of farming to the wider community. And then on top of that, we've got to really start to get to grips to understand with a much more stringent and complicated regulatory framework that looks very carefully at a lot of things we've done to ensure that we don't have negative impacts. So it has become very complex and difficult to deal with, but hey, you know, a lot of farmers are in this game because we love the land, we love the environment, we are extremely passionate about doing the noblest profession in the world in terms of producing food, healthy, you know, environmentally sustainably produced food for people, and that's pretty inspiring.
Indeed, and with the current situation around COVID-19, tourism shot to pieces, how important is the primary sector to New Zealand's economy?
I think our primary sector has one of the greatest opportunities to reinvigorate, and it's been very clear that we've had some problems in our public image, but the primary sector has continued to work on trying to reduce our environmental impact, move our products up the value chain. With the terrible thing that's happened to New Zealand tourism, we do have an opportunity to fill that gap for however long it needs to be, and really show our value to New Zealand and New Zealanders. And we can, I've just spent a lot of time talking with amazing people who are just 100% focused on saying, listen, not only can we deliver for, you know, rural communities, not only can they deliver for New Zealand in terms of economic recovery, more jobs, but we can do it and where we continue to get improvement in our sustainability and our environmental practices. And if we capture that opportunity right now as a primary sector, we can see fantastic opportunities for growth and creating employment for New Zealanders. And it can really secure and create a bright future for our children, which is, I think, is pretty exciting.
Thank you very much for your time today, William.
No problem. Thank you.
Hello, Petra. Thank you for joining me again this week.
Hi, Angus. Thanks for having me again.
For those that missed last week, please can you tell me about the work you do?
So I'm a climate scientist at NIWA, which is the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. I have experience in providing climate change information for the likes of regional councils and businesses, and communicating what climate change may mean for different parts of the country and different sectors.
Last week we talked about climate change in Canterbury and what farmers can expect in the region moving forward. Today we're looking at the Wairarapa. From a climatic perspective, do you break this region down into different zones?
Yeah, so we have three main zones in the Wairarapa. So in the west we have the mountainous zone, which includes the Rimutaka and the Tararua ranges, which have higher rainfall totals and generally cooler temperatures than the rest of the region. The plains in the centre of the region experience far less rainfall because they're in the rain shadow of those ranges, warmer temperatures and the lowest wind speeds, so quite sheltered area. The eastern uplands on the eastern side of the region are somewhere in the middle of the two, with higher rainfall totals than the plains, but lower than the western ranges, and slightly cooler temperatures than the plains as well. The east coast and the highest peaks of the ranges are the windiest parts of the region.
So there's actually quite a dramatic variation in the environment within the Wairarapa.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that the central plains area is really, it's one of the parts of New Zealand that we actually experience some of the most extreme temperatures in particular, and it's also very dry. So comparing that to the mountains or the ranges that are quite close by is quite striking.
Is there a predominant direction in which the Wairarapa gets its weather, or does it vary depending on the season and location?
So because most of the Wairarapa is sheltered from the west by the ranges, it often stays dry during westerly airflows, which get caught up on the western side of those ranges. So sometimes during these types of airflows, the Wairarapa may experience the fern effect, which is when winds are coming from the west and they're descending from the ranges and they dry out because they're dry from dropping all their rain on the western side, and they warm up quite a lot as they descend down the leeward side or the the downwind side of the ranges. So that can create quite dry, gusty and warm conditions in the plains. The hill country in the eastern side of the Wairarapa also often shelters the plains from easterly rain-bearing winds. So that makes the area around Masterton and Martinborough one of the driest parts of the North Island. The Wairarapa is exposed to heavy rain from the south and the east, which can cause flooding.
Have we seen changes in rainfall across the region over the past 100 years?
There's not actually a lot we can see in the data. So we've got a reasonable record for Masterton, but there aren't actually any clear trends that we can see in either annual or seasonal rainfall or high intensity rainfall events.
And what about sunshine hours in the region? Has there been any changes there?
Yeah, so there has been an increase in sunshine hours for the Wairarapa, which is measured in Masterton over the past around about 50 years. And this is due to generally reducing cloud cover on average. And we expect to see this trend continue in terms of increasing sunshine hours with ongoing climate change, as increasing greenhouse gas concentrations in our atmosphere drive changes to our atmospheric circulation and clouds.
And temperature, are we seeing a change in the range of temperature in the Wairarapa or extreme events?
Yeah, so in terms of your average temperature, we have seen an increase in those trends for Masterton. So we've got over 100 years of temperature records for Masterton. So it's a really good kind of index station for, it's one of our main sites in New Zealand that we use to monitor our long-term temperature change. So we have seen an increase in average temperatures in Masterton. We've also seen an increase in the numbers of hot days or days above 25 degrees and reducing numbers of frosts, particularly in the past few decades. We're also seeing an increase in the number of growing degree days in the Wairarapa, which is an important metric for the primary sector as it gives indications of the timing of plant development over a season.
Is there any data around more extreme events, for example, flooding, hail or snow?
We haven't got any data around in terms of trends of those extreme events. Of course, the Wairarapa has experienced certain events at different points in time in history. One in particular is the 2017 to 2018 summer, where Masterton experienced its hottest summer on record. And like I said before, those records go back over 100 years, so that's quite a significant record to break. Masterton also recorded its highest temperature on record during January 2018, which was a massive 35.4 degrees. So that's, again, in a record that goes back over 100 years, that's a really significant record to break. And these long-lasting warm conditions during that summer caused a range of impacts on the primary sector, including the grape harvest, which happened a few weeks earlier than usual.
Is there any evidence that the timing of seasons are changing?
So, like I said before, we're continually seeing increases in temperature across the board throughout most of New Zealand, including in the Wairarapa. 2016 was our warmest year on record, and five of our warmest years on record have occurred in the past 7 years. Anecdotal evidence suggests that crops may be changing in tune with these temperatures, just like I mentioned with the grape harvest in 2018. And these signs are likely to continue as our planet continues to warm. So we'll have our seasons getting warmer in general, and so the kind of traditional markers of our seasons may change over time, with things like date of the first frost getting later, date of the last frost getting earlier, and things like that.
What climatic trends can farmers expect to see over the next 50 years in the Wairarapa? Is it much different to Canterbury?
It's relatively similar to Canterbury, actually. So in terms of the long-term warming trend, it's likely to continue to get warmer with increasing numbers of warm days and reducing numbers of frosts. So that's kind of similar throughout the whole country. I mean, obviously places that currently experience fewer frosts won't have the large decreases that other places will. The Wairarapa currently does experience quite a large number of frosts in the winter, so those will reduce over time. Annual rainfall isn't expected to change too much in the coming few decades, but seasonal rainfall may increase or decrease a small amount compared to present. But by the end of the century, so towards 2100, it's expected that average rainfall will actually decrease in the region, which may lead to more severe droughts. And we're seeing this kind of trend quite commonly on the east coast, particularly of the North Island. So all the way from Northland right down to the Wairarapa, this kind of reduction in rainfall overall by the end of the century. And then on the flip side, we may also start to see more intense rainfall events as the atmosphere warms more and it can hold more energy and more moisture and have those more intense storm events.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Petra.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you to my guests today, Petra Pierce and William Beetham. William provided great insight into his farming business and good anecdotal evidence, both from his personal experience on the farm and weather logbook entries through the generations that date back to the 1800s. William is experiencing climate change. Winters are starting to get warmer with less frost events and less average rainfall. Around 200 mils less of rain is falling on average on his property. Changes to his farming system have been made to accommodate environmental change as well as changes in market conditions and regulatory requirements. Typical trading periods have changed and there is a focus on farming the shoulder seasons more when feed supply is typically at its highest. William finds that autumn is his biggest risk and spring feed is reliable even in the toughest years. Petra talked about the variations of the different areas or zones within the region. Temperatures have increased, which supports William's logbook entries. Reducing frosts and increasing growing days will become more prevalent according to NIWA's prediction. NIWA's predictions also suggest that as sunshine hours increase and we continue to warm, we will eventually see increased prolonged drought periods. Summer 2017-2018 saw Masterton have its hottest summer on record, and its hottest day on record was in January of 2018. Which was a blistering 35.4 degrees. There is no doubt global warming is and will continue to provide challenges for New Zealand farmers. What is quite interesting though, is that the sheep and beef sector's greenhouse gas emissions have been reducing each year. By 2015, its greenhouse gas emissions were 19% below the 1990 baseline used internationally. This has been achieved through a combination of decreasing sheep numbers from a high of 70 million in the 1980s to around 29 million in 2015. And steady improvements in productivity and performance have resulted in almost the same amount of sheep meat being produced. Productivity improvements include higher lambing percentages, faster finishing, and higher carcass weights because of improved genetics, better forage species, and feed management. Not only have total emissions reduced, but the amount of greenhouse gas emissions produced per kilogram of meat has continued to reduce at the rate of about 1% per year. Beef cattle have had a similar reduction in greenhouse gas emissions produced per kilogram of meat. Whilst there is still work to be done, realistic goals and targets that are workable should be set, and equally, policymakers need to look at the great work and improvements that have been achieved in recent times. Acknowledge the improvements. They are there and support and encourage an industry that, quite frankly, does more for New Zealand than any other. Thank you for listening and catch you next time on Factum Agri.